This is Fresh Air. We're right in the middle of hurricane season, which starts in June and runs through November. So far this year, Hurricane Alberto blew in over Georgia, killing 31 people. Beryl, which was just downgraded to a tropical depression, dropped heavy rains and set off tornadoes in the southeastern U.S. And Tropical Storm Chris is currently brewing in the Atlantic Ocean. A hurricane, as defined by the National Weather Service, is a tropical cyclone which whips up winds of 74 miles per hour or more. Dr. Robert Sheets is the director of the National Hurricane Center located in Coral Gables, Florida. For 30 years, he's been tracking, analyzing, and preparing the public for the onslaught of hurricanes. Before heading up the National Hurricane Center, Dr. Sheets worked in hurricane research. He flew more than 200 missions, gathering data from the inside of hurricanes. He says you encounter a lot of turbulence, but flying through a hurricane is not as bad as most people would think.
What's so dramatic about it, though, is that you start off approaching the storm, nice, calm, smooth flight. Then you come into the first rain band, and you get bumped around a little bit, break between the rain bands, and it sort of calms down, but now clouds, you look down at the surface, you see the ocean, streaky nature of the ocean, green streaks, and then as you get into stronger winds, maybe it turns to foam, and now the turbulence gets a little stronger as you're breaking into the inner rain bands, and then you get to the eye wall, and then you may get some of the severe turbulence, and you hear all this noise. It's very noisy at that stage. Again, all of the rain or ice pellets, whatever, beating on the outside of the airplane. And then, boom, you break through the eye wall, and you're in the eye, and it can be actually spectacular, quite beautiful, quite serene. And I think just the contrast of that, just flying through the eye wall and then breaking into the eye, and it's just smooth and quiet.
And this is this calm that's right in the center of a hurricane.
That's right. In the eye of the hurricane, it's very calm. It's the eye wall that right. Where all the strong winds are that it's sort of like a donut, the meat of the donut that surrounds the center of the storm, and that's where the strong part of the hurricane is and where most of the destruction takes place.
Any close calls?
Well, in my own case, about three in the 16 years that had those come close together, I would have quit, but fortunately the three incidents came far enough apart that the memory was such that you forgot the previous one.
Well, what happened?
And one was the worst one that I was ever on was in Hurricane Gladys in 1969 in the Gulf of Mexico. It really wasn't all that strong of a storm, but the aircraft fell about 4,000 feet in a matter of just a few seconds, and some people that were not strapped in got thrown to the ceiling, and material came through the air and struck one of the people who was seriously injured. And so on until we hit the bottom and sort of eased out of it. We thought that we were going to have major problems with the aircraft, popped some rivets and so on. But we got back, the aircraft was x-rayed and it did pop rivets and those kind of things. But it flew fairly well.
When you're flying into a hurricane, what exactly are you measuring?
It's primarily what you're measuring is the wind, temperature, pressure, and the moisture content that's there. The structure of the storm, that is, where the eye wall areas, how strong are the updrafts, how large of an area is covered by the rain bands, how hard is it raining. This is based on radar simulations, not radar simulations, but radar observations. There are cloud physics instruments that try to look to see what the cloud is made of, what size of particles are there, how much ice is above the freezing level, how much liquid is above the freezing level, what size are those droplets, all these things to try to understand better the dynamics of the hurricane itself.
You've predicted that there will be more hurricanes in the future, that actually the last couple of decades have been relatively quiet. You predict a return to the 40s, 50s, and 60s. What signs do you have which indicate that?
Yeah, I don't know as we have all that great a confidence in those kind of predictions on a decadal basis or on a seasonal basis. We do see cycles of hurricane activity, and certainly in the 40s and 50s, we had a lot more hurricanes that were affecting Florida and the East Coast, and particularly strong hurricanes, than we've seen in the last two decades. And so we've watched this cycle. We went for the 40s, for instance, there were about 10 major hurricanes. A major hurricane for us is a Category 3 or stronger, greater than 110 miles per hour. And there were 10 of them in the decade of the 40s that struck the continental United States. Decade of the 50s, there were 8. In the 40s, it was primarily over the Florida peninsula. In the 50s, it was primarily up the East Coast. In the 60s, there were 6. That was primarily in the Gulf Coast. In the 70s, there were 4. Those were all in the Gulf Coast. And in the 80s, there were 5. And we started to see a little shift back, some in the Gulf Coast. And then, of course, we had the Hurricane Hugo on the East Coast, Hurricane Diana. And then in the 90s, we've seen Hurricane Bob and now Hurricane Andrew, and last year Hurricane Amelia. So we're starting to see some of this, Amelia. We're starting to see some of this shift back. And some research by Professor Bill Gray at Colorado State University has indicated that some of this cycle of activity may be associated with the rainfall over the Sahel area in Africa. And that rainfall there goes through about 20 to 25 year cycles of drought or wet phase. And right now we seem to be coming out of that 20 to 25 year drought phase, maybe getting up to near normal this year, or maybe slightly below or slightly above normal. And so if the wet phase returns, there is a very strong correlation between that and major hurricane activity over Florida and the East Coast.
Okay. Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Robert Sheets. He's the director of the National Hurricane Center. We're talking from his office in Coral Gables, Florida. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Robert Sheets. He's director of the National Hurricane Center. Well, it seems that the hurricane problem is becoming a people problem in that so many people have moved along the coastal areas of the United States from Texas on up into New England. What problems do you see then as the director of the National Hurricane Center when it comes to the question of evacuation and notifying the public about an impending hurricane?
Well, we've done a lot of very foolish things. Is that we think in terms of the short record of possibilities of hurricanes, and so we develop areas where in the past we've had strong hurricane activity, and we'll certainly have it there in the future, but we forget about that because we had this 20 to 25-year period. And so we just place so many people now in harm's way. And the problem is not only that are we putting people out there, but we're not doing a very good job in the way we construct. First decision is whether or not you're actually going to develop barrier islands, and we've clearly done a lot of development of that. But then even when we build a structure out there, we don't build one that's hurricane resistant in terms of the wind. We have the flooding problem, the storm surge problem. So it is a people problem, exactly that. And now our evacuation times, because of the large concentrations of people, range greater than 30 hours, maybe 36, 40 hours. New Orleans is somewhere around 70 to 80 hours. And we know we don't have the skill to provide accurate warnings at those long lead times.
Are you saying, too, that as much as there's development along the coast, that there haven't been enough roads built in order to get this mass of people out of harm's way?
Right. What happens is the more roads you build, the more you develop. So I get entangled in some of those arguments frequently about a new bridge, a new road, and they say, don't we need a new bridge or new road to this barrier island because we've got a hurricane evacuation problem? And I say, yes, you do, but don't increase the number of people out there after you put the new bridge and the new road in. So it's sort of a never-ending process. You go ahead and put the new bridge and the new road in, and now just more people go out there, and they're actually worse off than they were when they added the previous road. But you're correct, is that the infrastructure is not kept up with the numbers of people that are out there.
Well, I have a confession to make. I have been along the coast of the Atlantic when a hurricane's blown in, and I've stayed there because that lure of the big angry ocean, I mean, it's very exciting, and for better or for worse, I haven't felt that I was in some kind of danger. Do you understand, though, the lure of wanting to be in a hurricane, or does that seem crazy?
Well, there's a lot of people that have that feeling here in South Florida. Most people had not been through the core of a major hurricane. Along came Hurricane Andrew and even some of the previous hurricanes that may have threatened, and they were almost disappointed that it didn't come because of the excitement that you're talking about there. But not one person that I know of today who lives in South Dade, where the core of Hurricane Andrew ever wants to go through another hurricane. And I think that's always true. Anytime you've been through the core of a major hurricane, you never want to see another one. So there is that excitement, that lure of the storm that's there. But once you've experienced that big one, you don't want to be near one the next time.
Well, how do you get the public to take a hurricane threat seriously?
Where you've experienced the hurricane, here in South Carolina, where Hurricane Hugo went, in Mississippi, where Hurricane Camille went, some 1969, we don't have a problem with those people. They're not going to be there the next time. Where we have the problem is the new people who come down, but more so the people who've been there 10 to 15 years and have been brushed by a minor storm or just the fringe of a hurricane, and they think they know what a hurricane's all about. So usually the new resident, they're pretty scared about hurricanes. You get some response from them, but it's the ones who've been there a few years and have experienced the fringe of a hurricane, and they sort of influence the new residents, say, well, it's not so bad, and so we'll stay. So the best thing we can do is just through the educational process is to try to bring home to them what happens in a major hurricane. Substitute education for experience. Take the experiences of the people in Hurricane Andrew and Hugo and Camille and some others and say, look, here's what would happen in your community. You really don't want to be there.
Well, let's say someone does stay in their house. Where is the safest place to be, and what are some do's and don'ts?
Okay, a couple of things. One is you got to get away from the water. That's, again, you're going to have the drowning situation, and I don't care how strong your house is built. If you're going to be below water level, you've got a problem. So you've got to get off of the barrier islands, away from the water. Now, as you're away from those locations, the best thing you can do is to make sure that you have good covers for the windows. My own house here in Hurricane Andrew was in the north eye wall, and many others of our staff, and with good covers on the windows, then the interior of the house was in good shape. Now, if you're in the house, away from the water, and you still have problems, which a lot of people did, with windows coming out, doors coming off, pieces of roofs coming off, all of those kind of things, the safest place in the house is the same as you would treat it with a tornado, except down here we don't have basements. So where you go is you go to an interior closet and a bathroom, a small room that's interior, away from the outside walls, away from the windows and doors, and get in that location, maybe put a mattress over you, but just basically ride out the storm in one of those areas.
I noticed that the hurricanes have been named through the year 1999, working ahead, obviously.
Well, what we do is give you a little history of that, is that during World War II, typhoons and hurricanes, and they're the same thing, were frequently named by the soldiers after their sweethearts or wives or girlfriends. And in Australia, they were named after politicians they didn't like.
Is that right?
There were some of those things that took place. And then after World War II, we started off with the old military alphabet because of radio communications down through the various islands, the Abel Baker Charlie kind of an approach. And then about the mid-50s, we found that people were having problems with that because comes along Abel this year. Well, is that like Abel last year or Abel 3 years ago or whatever? And so we found that by naming storms, then people can associate with it. For instance, if your listening audience, when I say Hurricane Camille, that means something. They don't even have to know that it was the third storm in 1969. So starting in the mid-50s, then storms were named after females. And then primarily due to the women's movement in 1979, and also our parent organization is the Department of Commerce. There was a female Secretary of Commerce at that time. And so we changed in 1979 to alternating male and female names. Now, we came up with six lists of names. And we, in this case, is all of the countries in this hemisphere. We, under the United Nations World Meteorological Organization, we have the Hurricane Committee. I chair that committee, 26 to 27 countries. So in 1979, the six lists of names were put together that represented male and female, alternating male and female, Spanish, English, and French. And then you have to make sure that the name is not obscene in one language or another, and that happens once in a while. So it went before that committee. The list, six lists of names were approved, and those six lists of names are then recycled, rotated every 6 years, except when you have a major hurricane. For instance, Hugo, it was a very major hurricane for the United States, and it was then retired. Any country can request that the name be retired. And when it comes back, it'll be Humberto. And hurricane we just had down here, Andrew, that will be Alex when it comes back, and so on. So that's the way the naming process takes place.
Well, I thank you very much, Robert Sheets, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
You're welcome.
Dr. Robert Sheets is director of the National Hurricane Center in Coral Gables, Florida. This is Fresh Air.